Welcome to the Zebra Rebel Podcast. I'm your host, Talia Herring, and this is the podcast where we rebel against Zebel one episode at a time. In today's episode, I'm interviewing Lee Schooler, who has been in impact investing since 2009, meaning that she gets investors to focus on really cool things like climate innovation. She lived in the US and Europe and Africa. She founded GITA, which is the Global Impact Tech Alliance. She's been active in developing the impact ecosystem in Tel Aviv and set up the impact investing advisory at Deloitte. She's worked with new impact funds, accelerators, public actors. What is a public actor?
That could be like the innovation authority, the municipalities, anyone who's in the public sector that wants to be in this. They give out grants, they do incentives, they do workshops. The impact world is very closely related to the issue that the public sector cares about.
So you've done some amazing things, and I'm just so excited that you're here. Like, I'm not really sure what to do about it. I heard you talk a few weeks ago at the Fossil Free Israel webinar, talking about divesting from fossil fuels, and wow, it was just amazing. I was mind blown. Like, I love everything that you said. It made so much sense to me that there should be an overlap between financial investment and what's good for the climate and our future. It's just like very logical to me that the solutions for climate change also benefit societal issues and financial issues. But it's cool to see the proof that investing in these things that are good also pay off financially right now. Like, it's an investment in clean tech, but also you're getting a good investment for your savings right now. And I love that because people shouldn't be sacrificing in order to like be part of the change that needs to happen. Like, it should come from a place of what you're gaining. And I love that. I think that it's cool because also when we talk about climate change, I think of it as an economic issue, right? If we're having, you know, crazy droughts and food shortages and lack of clean water and normal weather patterns, that's going to affect business. That's going to affect, you know, our safety and our economy in so many different ways. So it totally is a no-brainer for me, but like, I love seeing it proven in other aspects. And I also appreciate like that this is just an industry that's growing and developing. And I think it makes so much sense. So I want you to tell the listeners a little bit about how this all connects together, what impact venture capital is, and what's the connection between doing good and financially pushing for growth. Because it could also be a little bit confusing if we're growing our economy, like, well, that means that we have to buy more and then we have to keep on this like consumeristic pattern that we've been doing. So how does that work?
So happy to. I'll talk a little bit about, just to zoom out a bit about impact investing. So venture capital is one world of investment, but impact investing in general is a really awesome field, which challenges, I think, the basic like paradigm that we're born in, that you can either do good or make money, and you have to actually choose. And if you're doing good, well, you know, forget about ever having any money, and you're supposed to be like driven by your values and be in like this moral high ground where you just, you know, live off air and love, right?
But like, what about social workers and teachers? Like, you see in society that there is a big difference between people that are taking a paycheck or people that are doing it because they care.
So yeah, so we live in that paradigm that, yeah, this is the sacrifice you must make. If you want to do well, you know, you put all your values aside and you make money in any way possible, forget all values and everything. Now, we are also taught that this is how it's always been. This is the world. Wake up, smell the coffee, be an adult. All that is not true. First of all, it is a modern outlook. It is a modern approach. It is a modern paradigm. It's barely been in existence before the 80s. So really, really modern. Your parents grew up in a different world. My parents grew up in a different world. I was even born, like, I was born like early 80s. So like, it's new. But part of the paradigm that brought up that either values or money also brought in that this is how it's always been. And so we're brainwashed in that way. And we believe that that's how things are and that we have to make a choice.
When did you make that?
Or we do well. So that's like, we can talk a little bit about history and more our economic history. But Just even think about it. Even the example you mentioned, teachers and social workers, they were not always poor. Teachers used to have a high standing in society, right? So this is a new phenomenon. One of the things that brought about the 1970s, there was a big economic crash all over the world. Basically, the economy tanked. There had an oil issue. But pre-1970s, the concept of the business was supposed to actually maximize all kinds of stakeholders. A business was there to make money, yeah, but also to benefit the workers and benefit society and benefit the community and bring taxes to the government and do a lot of things. And then the economy tanked. A lot of things happened, won't go into history, but basically this idea that, you know, it's too much to put on the business. And there was this economist called Milton Friedman who got a Nobel Prize in economy. And it was like, the business of business is business. Profit only. That is a new idea. People just took it on really quickly. Wall Street rebounded. Financial industries became like super important. They weren't before. And we all started like worshiping profit. And more than that, this neoclassical idea came into the idea that we shouldn't connect anything that has to do with values and ethics in our business activity. Not only that it's impossible, but we shouldn't do it. It's wrong. It's like, ethically
it's naive.
It's naive, but like just like you shouldn't put business principles in your social or environmental activism, that's wrong, right? Like don't talk about profit or business when you're trying to do good in the world. That's ethically wrong. We are told that we shouldn't, if we want to be a good business person, we shouldn't include any values and ethics into that. And that was like the paradigm we were born in. Now, if we look, though, with open eyes, we see that paradigm has been broken and shaken. Now, if we think about what we buy as consumers, we make choices that we put our values into play, right? Sure. We may or may not buy disposable cups. We may or may not buy jeans that were made with slave labor. We may or may not buy, you know, blood diamonds based on our value system. So here we are, acting as economic actors. We were told that all our values should be set aside when we're acting in the economic sphere, but we already aren't doing that. We're already making ethical choices as consumers. We're already making ethical choices as employees, right? We're already thinking like, wait, time. My time is the biggest resource I have in the world. I can choose where to put my time, which is where to work. You know, most of my waking hours is going into that. Do I want to work in a company that's destroying the world? That where I want to put my most precious resource? And people are putting their values in that decision as well. And another sphere where people are putting their values, and this whole space is called the impact economy value system, where you're starting to put in your value system and your subjective ideals in your economic decisions, and you reject the premise that for some reason, when we put our economic hat, we have to take off all the rest of ourselves as individuals.
It's very extreme. Like, we have this clarity, and maybe it's easier for us to like stop the nuance and to stop combining worlds and then just have this black and white of separate worlds, and then we don't get confused and we feel like my morality is not on the line, and to make sure that my values are separate. And then it's like, you know, your personal life and your work life. I think that's very comforting for people to not have that ambiguity when it comes to decision making.
So what we find out that not only is it like not morally wrong to connect our values and our business, it is actually a good idea and it actually works. And if we are able to have a little flexibility of our mind, because it's only in our mind, it's not in reality, and have two objectives, not only one. So profit and impact or climate change or whatever issue we want to change. And we try to maximize our impact. So basically to be effective in the solutions we bring to the world and create a business model. It's not that complicated. Is there ways to do that?
Is it always two goals or is it sometimes three? Like, is there a combination or just endless, I guess?
Of course, it's endless. Like, it doesn't have to be, it's not always anything, right? Our world is our world. Just like we can choose, you know, what school to go to because it hits one of the stuff we want to do and another thing. You know, it could be great academically and great socially. It doesn't have to be only one thing. That it doesn't make any sense that only business activity is the only thing in the world where it has to be pushed and driven by one factor. When actually, as we live in our world, which is complex, we try to maximize multiple factors. That's how we operate, right? We try to make decisions that hit all of our key priorities. It's very human, it's very normal, and it's very possible. And so I actually like to say, you know, in the business world, they talk about maximizing profits. And I like to say optimizing. You know, we optimize multiple variables. We do that a lot. And we're able to do that in such complex systems today with AI. We can optimize thousands of variables. Surely we can find a way to optimize profit and optimize the change we want to see in the world. That means we could be a company that, I don't know, trying to capture CO2 molecules from the atmosphere. And so we will optimize the amount of CO2 we capture or our measurable impact. And we will optimize the profit we can make. So we'll find, you know, good business model that covers our costs and we make a profit. We don't have to capture the entire profit possible. We have to find the place where we're making a good profit and we are changing the world the way we want to. The idea of the impact economy is a paradigm shift that is already happening. And impact investors take that shift and use it in the investment world. So generally, investors following that old paradigm or that not so old paradigm would look at a company and go like, where should I put my money? We all have some sort of capital. Hopefully if we are in the Western world, et cetera, we also have savings. It's kind of mandated by law. We have to save for pension. We have to put our money in bank accounts. We have to buy insurance products. So we have to have financial products, which are insurance, bank accounts, credit, and savings. All these financial products are one way or another participating in the global capital markets, in the people investing money. We have a bunch of people, if we know them or not, investing our money. It means if you have money in a bank account, it's not just sitting there waiting for you to pick it up. It's taking all the money they have in their accounts and investing it in companies in the stock market or in bonds. All our money is invested all the time. And over the last 30, 40 years, the wisdom was just look at the bottom line, just look at the profit. And that's how we decide if to invest in something. Impact investors do what we said about the impact economy. They look at the bottom line. And in addition, they look at the impact of the companies that they're investing in. And it comes from a point of view of also responsibility, because with all due respect, so if a company, and I'll go to the extreme, like involved in slavery or human trafficking or, you know, blood diamonds and death. Yeah, the company is absolutely responsible. But the company, the investor that invested in that company without seeing that, now, oh yeah, here's our money. Yeah, go ahead and do what you do.
Yeah.
Is also responsible. It's just like the consumers are responsible for buying that and not checking, wait, how is this so cheap? What's going on here?
Do you actually believe that the customers are responsible?
Well, I think it's not, you know, binary. It's not like one person's responsible and it's not equal responsibility, but a little bit, yeah. It's really comfortable to drink from a plastic cup and throw it out afterwards and not think about what happens to it, not think about the whole process, and it wasn't necessary.
Like choosing to
partially.
So you know about it.
Yeah. I mean, you know about it, but that was partially responsible. We have the choice what to buy. We're not solely responsible, right? Everyone holds a responsibility. But partially. And as long as we have a choice, then we're partially responsible. And investors absolutely have a choice. So impact investors go, we want to exercise that choice. We do feel responsible. And we want to make sure that who we invest in is not only not doing any harm, which is a whole sector called responsible investing or ESG. And I think that's where we meant we talked about divesting from fossil fuel. That is saying, with my money, I don't want to actively do harm in the world.
You have to take your money out of that bank account that's going to harm's way.
Yeah. Or go to a different bank that promises me a sustainability option. Mm-hmm. Or if I have to, you know, save money in a pension fund. I can choose which pension fund I put my money in. Again, reminder, those pension funds are not just sitting around like looking at your money. They are actively giving it to other companies for it to grow in profit. And what we find out again is that paradigm of either profit or doing good, which is like the impact world, is not true, which means we can choose to invest in company X that has no impact, but has, let's say, a 10% profit, or we can choose to invest in company Y, which has the same profit. So your money is having the same kind of return, but is actually actively supporting the world. That is a choice we have. And it kind of breaks that paradigm. We can do good and make money if we put in the right structures and business models, et cetera, in place. And the impact investing sector, it's about $1 trillion today.
Wow.
Which is quite a lot of money. Yeah. And the reason it's growing is because it's showing in quantifiable measures that you can make measurable impact and profit at the same time. It's possible.
So us as consumers, as people that are investing our money, how do we find out what banks to put our money in? What pension plans are best? Like, how do we go from here?
So I'll separate between being like a passive investor, which most of us are. The public is actually the holder of most of the investments of the world. And that's kind of what we said before, which is bank accounts, pension funds, and insurance policies, which we, most of us are exposed to one way or another. That is what we call institutional investing. That is the bodies who hold that money, the banks, the pension funds, et cetera. They are mandated by the government. They are regulated. They're not private money. It's what we call public. So here they have actually an obligation to report every year all their activity because they're mandated, right? The government says like, oh, you can't just invest other people's money.
Makes sense.
By law, right, without actually reporting what's going on there. In that space, it really actually depends, because it's a regulated activity, really depends what country you're in. Australia, then there, most of the, it's not quite called pension funds, it's a different name, but most of that is actually responsible investing or even impact. And so that's already done.
Because it's right
if you're in Israel. It's the regulation that's there. It's called the superannuum. It's not called the pension fund. And it's actually all these pension funds in Australia are nonprofits. And they were originally set up because pension is like looking at the future in general. They were all originally structured as something that is looking at the future, that they weren't allowed to invest in something that. So they are like way ahead. If you're looking at Israel, you have no options, really. You have a few actors that are better than the others in terms of their exposure to fossil fuels, but we still yet to have a proper financial institution that is committed to ESG. But it is a huge movement. We talk about the impact investors as $1 trillion. ESG investing is $40 trillion, more or less about 20%. Or 25% of total economic activity. So that is quite big, and it's growing like crazy, because we find that it actually is more profitable to have that kind of responsibility, because you're actually looking to the future. You kind of mentioned it in your introduction. A company that is exposed to, you know, all the climate challenges is actually at risk. You know, their profits are at risk as well. It's not only that they're doing bad to the environment. They are actively contributing to something that is destroying a lot of economic activity, which means they're exposed to economic risk as well due to the climate challenge. So what we see more and more, and it's just the climate side, but ESG, I'll mention, is environment, social, and governance. So it's not only companies that harm the environment and contribute to climate crisis, it's also companies that harm social values. So talk about slavery or gender equality or anything that is, you know, bad. And we can talk about how we define that bad. But
as well, yeah. And what's allowed?
What's the ban, right? So we find that companies that are not conforming to our basic values as a society and the social contract that we do have which we used to say, like, what can you do? They're making profit. What can we say? That's no longer okay. It's no longer okay to make profit off slavery or sex trafficking. Like, it's not okay. And it's not okay to say profit by all means. And we don't care how you made the money. And then just, you know, you kind of donate a little bit at the end of the year and go like, oh, with my profits, I will donate a bit to fix the damage that I made. Like, it doesn't make any sense.
I kind of think that, like, people are hesitant to deal with it now. Like, I kind of feel that the amount of excuses when it comes to taking action and making those shifts, it's kind of like with individuals, people are like, oh, when I have more money, I'll shop sustainable brands. Right now, I'll go to Zara and H&M. But in the future, when I can afford it, then I'll switch all my habits and do that. And with companies, it feels like when there's a policy or a law or someone enforcing it, then I'll make that switch. Until then, I'm going to do these like dances in between and make it look like the greenwashing is like the dance in between, right? Like I'm pretending to be involved, but like I'm going to wait for someone to force me to. And I just don't really get it, because if you know that that's where the future is, like, shouldn't we be already making those shifts? And that would save companies money because they would already have the infrastructure and they'd be going that path. But it's just a little bit confusing to me. Like, why do these excuses actually make business sense to me? You know what I'm saying? Like, it's like, oops, we realize that eventually it'll be too late and then we'll make these changes. Why not just apply it now?
Right. And I totally, like, I follow you, but I try not to judge people. You know, if someone doesn't have a lot of money and will buy like junk food and fast food,
clothes, yeah,
it's fair. You know, everyone can do what they can do, but a lot of us do have choice. And I think one of the key issues that this whole paradigm is challenging, that we've been kind of programmed to throw problems on someone else. We're like, you know, oh, the climate crisis is awful. The government should do something about that.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
These big corporations are
the corporations to change.
Like, right. Buying things in the corporations.
This idea that we're all kind of separated and everyone works in their own real realm and sphere and we have no contact to each other is, again, it's an idea, but it's not reality. The fact is, the governments will never do any. We know in a democratic system, the governments are elected by the public.
Mm-hmm.
They will never do anything that goes against the public. Clearly, that is the whole point. So for them to do something, they need to get a very clear signal from the public that that's what they are supposed to do. They are never going to be the first. They will always be the last. They will only do something after it's demanded and there's a consensus and everyone goes like, we want you to do X. They'll never be the first ones to do X. They're not the innovators. They're not the crazy, you know, activists. They are the elected officials that are supposed to represent our wants.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing with companies. The companies don't do stuff because they want to do it. Companies want to sell a product. They want to sell it to a maximum amount of people. The way we can influence them, yes, the governments can influence them with regulatory pressure, but companies are also influenced by two other things. One of them is the financial markets, because companies need money all the time. Something we kind of forget is that for sure corporations, but any company, and think about any one you know that runs a company, if it's a startup, if it's a shop, if it's any kind of initiative, they are constantly raising money.
Yeah, there's paychecks.
They constantly need more money for growth. They need to grow in order to sustain themselves. They need to grow. And for them to grow, they need to raise capital. So companies need money like we need oxygen. So if the money demands them to be different, they will do it. If you know anyone that has a startup and is raising capital, they're running to investors, they're asking for money. If those investors tell them, you can get an investment, but only if you confirm to ethical and environmental standards, it doesn't matter if the entrepreneur cares about the environment or not. They will do it. They will confirm to those standards because they need the capital. So another kind of driver for corporate activity is financial actors.
Mm-hmm.
And then the third one is the consumers. Of course, we can choose. If we are very clear about our preferences. If we all decide we don't want to have anything that has fossil fuels, the companies will take it out very clearly. Like, they don't care if a product has fossil fuels or not.
That's true. Why should they care?
They want to sell their product. Money.
Yeah. But what about products that are emitting a lot of carbon that are part of the problem, that are innately, that is the product of the company?
So what I'm saying is it's not binary. It's not that the governments have no power. They are very important, and the final regulatory kind of stamp will come from governments. But it won't happen without, you know, the public, without the company. Everyone has a role here. Anyone who pulls themselves out of this is actually not looking themselves in the mirror. We all have the opportunity to be impactful. And if it's through our financial exposure, so we all have bank accounts, we all have pension funds. As we grow older, these pension funds mean more. We all buy things, we all use things, and we all vote. In all our realms of our activity, or we should all vote, we can be influential and be impactful. And we're not just these passive actors waiting for someone to do something, because we, the public, are pushing this entire system. It doesn't mean the governments have no responsibility. And I feel the key challenge of this sector is being binary. So a lot of times I would say the thing and people are like, oh, so the governments have no power, so you're taking out the government. I'm like, no, they also have responsibility and power. It's not either or. It's not either be an activist or work with companies. You can be an activist and work with companies. You can be both. You can do both. You can make profit and make impact. We don't have to simplify these stories to one thing. That is how we got here.
Listen, I love it. I think it's brilliant. And my mind is like trying to picture this different reality. Like, how do we get people to believe or to trust or to hope for this when it's not our reality that we're currently existing in? Like, it's a different reality. It's literally an alternate universe. Like, I still need something to link in between these two realities for me to kind of grasp it. You know what I'm saying? Like, give me the hope.
Yeah, I look at things as a process. We're constantly moving. So, you know, one of the things I know is like that, you know, change is the only constant. So whatever is going on now is not going to continue. That is by fact. That is how the world works.
Yeah.
And so assuming that, you know, if that is your starting point, things are going to change. They have to. Everything changes all the time. We change. Everything changes. The whole world is changing. The climate is changing. Everything is changing. And so assuming that, the question is, where will it change to?
Yeah.
Will it get worse or will it get better? So considering the current, you know, inequality, it's absolutely there. We can't just ignore it. But can we operate as if that is the reality? And from now till the end of days, then high-tech people will make more. Is that what we're saying? That is a constant, that this is the only reality we can see? And assuming that we have a bit of imagination, creativity, and flexibility of mind of saying what is not what always will be, we can start playing in that game.
Yeah, it's kind of like playing pretend and fake it till you make it. It's being willful and allowing these different ideas to develop. And even if it's scary and it's out of our reality right now, like, worst case, okay, we'll balance it out. You know, let's try it out. Let's see what happens. What's the worst that could happen?
So assuming things will change and we have a better vision of how things could be, operate in that world. And I don't have a general answer, because like, if you are currently in the tech industry in Israel and you're making a lot of money, you're like, what can I do? This is reality, right?
Yeah.
You go like, well, assume things are changing and operate in a world where tech is integrated in society. How would you be then? Who would you hire? How would you operate? What could you do in order to bring on the change that you think should happen, without saying, oh, what can I do? I'm a helpless, you know, this is the way things are.
I'm on that. Yeah.
We know things change. And so if you're in the social sector, like I just set up a nonprofit after years working in the for-profit world and working with different kind of activists, et cetera. And we're very clear about having salaries that are fair. Like,
well, should be.
If you... As they should be, right? Like, because a lot of the situation is kind of static and getting bad, because even the people who are losing from the current situation don't have the creativity and the flexibility of their mind. You go like, wait, why should people in nonprofits make a quarter or a tenth of what people who are making in a for-profit activity? I work in nonprofits. Let's change it from within. So we'll have less people, but with higher salaries. And the more people kind of understand their responsibility on their impact themselves.
For sure. Then it's like a new cycle, right? That's how the market works. If these jobs are paying these wages, people are going to want to work in those jobs. And then it attracts a different type of team member. And then, you know, it's an advantage. And it really reforms like the new minimum wage for these types of jobs.
So, and I also think it's really important, especially for Israelis, to kind of open their eyes, right? Israel is, you know, it's my country, I love it, but it is an 8 million people country in tiny, like, side of the world. Look at what's going on in the rest of the world. This kind of shift on the activists and the way social environmental people act has happened around the world in the 90s, okay? We are so behind. It's almost kind of like, it's almost hard for me to answer these questions, because it's like we're just living in that paradigm and keeping our head down and being victims about a situation that is completely unnecessary and is really not representative of how the world works. In the 8 billion people live in the world, this is not how things work. And so it's not only about Israelis, but it's for everyone to kind of gain perspective and look around and see what other people are doing. If you think something is unjust or not right, think about how to fix it and not only to rail against, you know, that's unjust. Somebody fix it.
Yeah.
The more we are, you know, part of the solution, and that means like if we think the corporations are acting badly, well, some of us could be on the streets, you know, being activists against them, but really, a lot of us could be working with them to tell them what they should be doing differently.
Our position, our influence, our power is so specific to the context of our reality, right? So you can work in a company and feel that it's not, you know, quote unquote environmental, but you can make such waves happen in any setting. And that is something that is only in your hands. And people ask me all the time, you know, what could I do in order to live more sustainably? And I'm like, talk to people, right? Go to your manager, talk to your coworkers, talk about, okay, why is the mezgan on right now? We don't need it on. Okay, let's not order Wolt and let's change our culture of using disposable plastic. You know, let's talk about how we can get more education here and talk about our ways of, you know, reducing electricity in the building. Someone reached out to me who works at IKEA and was telling me about some of the changes that she raised to the company. And it's just insane to see that one person can really get a following in the setting where you have a voice, where you have a community, and then you can really use your role as an employee to make a huge difference in a company with the resources that are already in existence there. It's like, wow.
We should pick that up also, because we actually, I just launched a course with Heschel, which is a big sustainability organization in Israel, about
I interviewed them like, on my creating podcast episode. They're amazing.
Oh, awesome. So we're doing a course together where we're talking about the climate crisis, and we're talking about the role of the private sector and really talking about the role of the individual employee, mm-hmm. not the manager, et cetera. Because I've been a consultant around the last few years as well. And I've seen how the biggest and most meaningful and fastest changes happen from another driver of a company. We talked about the government. We talked about, you know, the clients or the customers. We talked about the investors. But a key driver is the employees. And so one of the things I've seen is like if someone in the company not only goes to their manager, but sends out a company-wide kind of, guys, I've been thinking about our climate impact or our social impact, and I would like to set up a meeting with anyone in the company who cares about this.
Love it. Yeah.
You would be shocked to know how many people, and I've like supported this process in different companies, big corporations too.
It's fascinating.
And like 50 or 60 people may show up for that meeting. without knowing each other. And by managing that process and even just sort of saying, okay, what can we do? Each department kind of said like, oh, we do that, what can we do? Set up a plan. When a group like that comes to the CEO, and I don't care how big this company is, but that the CEO learns that the employees across departments are engaged on their own time, voluntarily in something that they care about in the company, they will write a check immediately. They're like, oh, wow, that's awesome. What do you need? What do you need? Go here. They, you know, CEOs and any kind of like executive management, board management are thrilled to see that kind of engagement. They're looking for that kind of engagement. And so that is a really quick way to make dramatic changes in the company. If you do have not only one employee coming to their manager, but a group of them. Yeah, saying like, we care about that. We'll put our time and resources. We want not to volunteer somewhere and clean up a beach. We want our company to be active in this space. And we will put our time. We'll do it. I've seen really quick turnarounds happen from a very quick process.
Could you give me an example? I'm so serious.
It's a little difficult because I was a consultant. So it's kind of like, you know.
Without names.
I can't tell the names, right. So I can tell you about a big financial institution that, as I said, finance has power, has responsibility, and create motion. So this is a big financial institution that kind of feels employees realize they are in a position of power, but they are not using that power in any way. And they're not, they don't have impact investing. They don't have ESG investing. And again, someone sent out an email of like, yes, we do kind of volunteerism, but who cares here about finding financial products that can actually do good and in our, what we call our core business, which is being a bank, can influence the world, you know, influence the climate crisis. And this is a company, it's not an Israeli company, but they have about 3,000 employees. So it's a big company. And they sent out this email with approval from the manager, like they didn't just do this, without. And about 300 people showed up. It was a Zoom call, which is crazy. I mean, that is 10% of the company. And 300 people were like, absolutely, why are we not creating, you know, financial products, loans, whatever, accounts, special accounts that have to support the climate transition. And just the amount of people who showed up and their levels. So there are people who are senior management, there are people who are very junior and across all the departments. And it was during COVID, right? So people were kind of home and they had the extra time. But very quickly, they kind of broke out into groups and they started doing like, oh, okay, we can map out what other banks are doing. Oh, we can do that. So they just did some tasks, did some groups. And there was such an amazing amount of people with so much enthusiasm that they actually pulled out, and this isn't the finance world, so I don't know how many people would be interested in it, but they created like a loan product for solar homes, for roof solar home systems that, you know, came out to the public really quickly, way faster than if, you know, executive management said, we need to do something. It's just the guys in the loan department were like, we can do that. What should we do? Oh,
yeah.
We got in the market. And they kind of made it happen. It was such a wake-up call for the executive management that they actually created a whole sustainability branch afterwards, and they were so excited and surprised. They had no idea their employees care about the issues. So, all is to say, like, I mean, I can pull out some more examples, but generally, we all have some kind of potential for impact. We could all map out what we are exposed to. And if we care about the climate crisis, we can look and just with very clean eyes go like, okay, yes, the government needs to put regulation. Yes, the corporations need to change. Yes, all true. But what can I do? Not in terms of like, I'll recycle. What is the most effective thing that I could do, most impactful in terms of measurement of like CO2 reduction and transition change that I can do that will actually make an impact.
Mm-hmm. And how could someone make this list, right? How could they think out from their position just simply what they're most interested in or what's most impactful when it comes to climate change and what's the biggest bang for your buck of what you could ask to a company to change, you know?
So there's a few things. First of all, there's, you know, the IPCC list every year that kind of map out what's going on with the climate and which industry is contributing how much So we know, let's say, the food industry is responsible to about a third of, you know, emissions and in general greenhouse gas emissions. So we know, and we all eat, clearly.
Sure.
Right? So we know a third of the problem, and all we have to do actually to address the problem is to reduce by 20% the global change. But a third of the problem is in our food. So one thing we can do is kind of, you know, learn and understand, like, wait, it's about waste and it's about livestock consumption. That's the key issue. So we can go like, okay, let's just make sure, like, we separate don't waste food. Yeah. Actually learn what you're doing. If you already are, you know, vegan and you have zero waste, et cetera, you got nothing to do there. If you are throwing out most of what you buy in the supermarket, or if you find yourself kind of only going to, you know, that is actually much more impactful than recycling.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have to choose how much effort,
yeah,
look at what you're doing rationally and data-based, not emotionally. I know a lot of us are going like, oh, yeah, you know, it feels awful to not recycle a bottle of water.
Mm-hmm.
We should recycle. But in terms of the impact, we have much more importance on our food than on plastic, considering most of what we are supposed to recycle, we don't recycle. It's better not to buy plastic than to recycle it. And we put so much time and effort on recycling, and it's nice, but it really is not where the crux matter. The second part is in our investment products, really. So if we have access to money, it could be a little bit of money, it could be a lot of money, it could be our parents, it could be, if you know anyone in kind of a big organization, like unions or kind of any kind of labor association. So let's say teachers, usually all are part of one union.
Okay.
The meaning of a union on the financial side is that all their pension go to one institution and they have one agreement, all the teachers. If they together are a powerhouse, if they decide we are not going to put our pensions in a pension fund that, you know, finances oil and gas and plastic and all this, you know, things that are destroying our world, they have a huge power.
Mm-hmm.
That is, you know, in Israel, that would be hundreds of billions of shekels, just the teachers. But how can we influence teachers union? Only if you know someone who's a teacher who can union rep, and they go to their union rep and go like, wait, what's going on with our pension?
Yeah,
I care about the future, I care about the children I teach, I care about my children, where is my pension? So I can't do anything, but if you know a teacher or you are a teacher, you can do something. If you have access to either money or someone who is in a unionizer group, they have power. We have that power. The more we are grouped together, we have more power as a public to change basically the products that exist at.
I think it's amazing because we're talking about not just say having power in a financial sense, right? It's not like, oh, you have this much in your bank account. You're a billionaire, so now you have the right to like speak your mind. This is like being part of a group, being part of a community. And when you can impact the community, then you really, you see that like it's a snowball effect. And that is like, it's like, okay, we grew up knowing what democracy is, so it's not that shocking, but it's like,
believe it or not,
shocking. It's so shocking,
it's shocking
to put in these terms. And I'm just like, what? I never thought about that. Huh?
Yeah. And you as a student, you know, I know some of your listeners are students, are part of an academic institution. Academic institutions also hold a lot of money. It's a pooled amount of money that you as a student can influence. You're a stakeholder. You're paying tuition.
Mm-hmm.
You're paying that institution. You are wrong.
I never thought about that. I went to law
school.
I never thought about like, I'm paying and what does buying the like, what does that mean? What do they?
Where's my money going?
I never thought about it. Never
yeah.
put my mind.
I know. So all kinds of ways we can, I'm not saying we hold all that responsibility, but we can make an impact through our different ways. So if we know institutions that hold a lot of money, if we know people who work or operate in those institutions, if we know someone who works in a bank, so anyone we know that we are somehow connected to can push the financial industry and the production industry to be different in different ways, right? So we can just bring it up there and raise that consciousness and there's a great statistic that the most impactful you can be is really changing your financial preferences, and it's 16 multiples time more effective than recycling to change your investment strategy. Because really, when an investor goes, I will not invest in you if you don't have a net zero strategy, if you are not responsible for your emissions, it is essentially like the government saying that. They have no choice.
I think it also speaks much louder than recycling, because recycling is, okay, I bought this product. I wanted the liquid inside. I wanted the product inside. I didn't want this container, but I had to, because that's what it was packaged in. And now as the consumer, I guess I'll be a good person and put it in this bin, hoping that another party on the other side that I don't really know what's going to happen, I hope they do something. So it's like two paths and sides. And this is someone saying that this is my money. This is my vote with my wallet of what I believe in. And this is my number one priority. And I think that's like so much more direct and so much more thoughtful of like what you're doing with your values. You know what I'm saying? Like, not trying to say one is trash and one is the best in the world, but like the relationship between what you're doing and your action is mind-blowing for me. That's so cool.
Yeah. And I think all it is really expanding the idea of activism,
mm-hmm.
And our spheres of operation activism to all the stuff that we have influence over. So we can be activists in the political sphere, and we should be. We can also be activists as consumers. We can be activists as investors. We can be activists as employees. We could be activists in all of the spheres of our lives to bring the organizations that we are facing to be more aligned to our values. We are allowed to, and we have the mechanisms to do it. We are also, what we should be empowered by is the knowledge that when these economic organizations tell us, oh, I can't do it because it will hurt my profits and I'm supposed to only max out of the profit, we can today be backed behind data, go like, it will not hurt your profits. Look at other companies, look at other countries. It will not hurt your profits.
You have
so that argument is out the window. Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah. So I think that empowers us to go like, bring it on. You know, we can influence by speaking, we can influence by buying, we can influence by working. And to what we should do is examine and diagnose basically our, just like a company does, our exposure to the different things in the world that have a positive or negative impact, and then decide where we want to put our efforts on it. And just be like data-based about it. You know, our emotions could lead us in terms of the values, but if we have $100, we should think about where we will get most bang for our buck for those $100 if we want to influence the climate change, and not just go like, whatever my emotions tell me to.
Or whatever society has told me is good, or whatever trendy right now.
And we're each different. We can all look around and see, what are my skills? What are my advantages? Where do I stand in society? What can I do? Considering it doesn't require a sacrifice, and now that I need to be poor. I can still run my life and have a career and have a future, hopefully, and be an activist on the stuff that I care about. And I'm not even saying what you have to care about. You could care about, you know, gender equality. You could care about justice. You want to just be transparent about what you care about, and then be strategic on how you influence that and make sure you're making the influence you want. And I think people who do that and are very pragmatic idealists are very effective.
I really appreciate that. And also because it takes a certain amount of like self-awareness of being like, this is my value, this is what's important to me, and I'm going to apply it in my skill set and my society, my culture, whatever I'm doing. But it's not like a one, like we were talking about before, of like nuance, right? Like,
yeah,
it's going to be like, you have to go to a protest and you have to be loud and angry and upset and blame people. It's like, how can I take an active part in where I am in my role, because this is my value. And it's a lot more humble of not trying to compare like one versus other, but it's a humble approach of like, these are my skill sets and this is the position I'm in my life. And I'm not going to blame it. If only I was like king of the world or president, then I would do this. Like, what can I do? Do you have a favorite quote or a podcast or book or something that you recommend? Just like one last piece of inspiration. This has been so inspiring, but, you know, in general.
So one book I would really recommend is Theory U. Which kind of goes across how things change. We said things change all the and kind of models how change, how things change and how we are part of that change. So kind of summarize what you just said now. It's a great book. And a podcast I love is called On Being with Krista Tippett. And they basically, I think, go through the different issues about being alive today. And I think one of the key issues that we should kind of bring into effect here in this conversation, but in the climate crisis in general, is that we're in the midst of a shift, not only in the paradigm, but in consciousness, in what is the good, in kind of thinking about what we want from society, what we want from each other. And the way we operate as economic actors is kind of a result of that. So first, we have to kind of think about who we are and what we care about, as you mentioned. And I think one of the key things to remember, and that is my final thing, is regarding empathy.
I love that.
When we put all this on the corporations or the government, we forget that they're human beings who work there. They're just people. They're just people that were told that same choice that we were told in the beginning, either make money or do good.
Yeah, and we vilify them.
Yeah, and if you do good, you won't have any money. And they could be from situations where that was not an option. So they went head in a paradigm that we were in as well and said like, okay, I'll make money. And they have shareholders and they're like, we're told to maximize profit. These are just individuals like us. They are not evil. You know, there's nothing evil about it. It is people under a situation and under incentive that we're told to do X or Y. And many of them, if we engage with them, are happy to change. They don't know how. They don't know what they should do differently. They don't know what their boundaries are. They still have to sell product or whatever. So not vilifying anyone and understanding we're all in this together. And we cannot afford to stand and point at other people. We don't have the time. We can't afford it. We now need to hold on to whoever's around and say, let's all do it together.
Let's get confidence too.
And yeah. So just remember to be empathetic to whoever is on the other side. And understand where they're coming from and help them go to the next stage, just like we're all on the journey. So with everyone else.
So beautiful. It's really beautiful. Thank you so much. Thank you so much for joining me today. This has been such a, like, I knew it was going to be a great conversation. Like, I knew it. I can't wait to re-listen to this because, we touched on such amazing, pragmatic, thoughtful, like, spiritual almost conversation. It was amazing. Thank you so much. And Zell Rebels, I hope you enjoyed listening to this. And if you did, please leave a review. And I'll see you on the next episode. Thank you so much, Levy, for joining me. This was
thanks, Talia.
Hey, Rebel. I hope you enjoyed listening to this episode almost as much as I enjoyed reporting it. I found it really powerful. I found it amazing that our previous episode was about prioritizing good over making money. And here we discussed that they don't actually have to be mutually exclusive. I think I'm starting to really fall in love with this idea that climate action isn't one-dimensional. It's not as expected. It's not one size fits all, and it looks different for different people. And that's okay. And I'm really excited to hear your thoughts on the matter. So please leave a review on Apple Podcasts and leave 5 stars on Spotify. Apparently you can't leave a review on Spotify. I didn't realize that. And tell me what topics you'd like me to cover next. On the next episode of the Zebel Rebel podcast, I'm going to be interviewing my dream, my heroes, Rehan Tammy, who is an attorney at Adam Tovidim, which is an Israeli climate law firm. They're making the climate law a matter of national urgency. They're bringing amazing changes to Israel. I'm really excited to have this conversation. I'm excited for you guys to listen and to join this conversation. I'm just a huge fangirl of the organization. I think they are monumental, and I'm really excited. So until then, stay rebellious. Bye, Rebels.